It is for me both unusual and timely to be with you on this first Sunday after Christmas. Unusual because, like many pastors after a busy Advent season and three services on Christmas Eve, I usually schedule my last vacation and Sunday for this week following Christmas. Of course, most pastors probably wouldn't admit it, but a service of carols does keep the spirit of Christmas around a little longer, especially with the sign text for this Sunday, like the circumcision and naming of Jesus, or the slaughter of the innocents and the Holy Family's escape to Egypt. Break the spell of the season, much like holiday hangovers and credit card bills do. And timely, because my time with you is quickly coming to an end. I wanted to be here with the faithful few, in fact, it was a few more than I anticipated this morning, who appear on the lowest Sunday of the year in attendance, and take this rare opportunity to preach on this Lucan text, which contains Simeon's haunting song, which talks about death just after a birth. Just a few nights ago on Christmas Eve, I questioned why Luke chose to give such a prominent part and role to some nameless shepherds in his telling of the birth of Christ. On this Sunday morning after Christmas, immediately following all the candlelight, carols, presents, and everything else that comes with our festive holy feast day, what in the world is Luke doing here talking about death? Alongside of Christmas carols, we continue to sing on this Sunday the Song of Simeon, which comes down to us in liturgical form in the Nunc Dimittis, sounds odd, dissonant, and somewhat out of place. So again, I question Luke in his placement of this odd coupling of old and faithful temple dwellers and the shadow of future death in Mary's time of great joy. In Luke's ongoing birth account, it is now 40 days after Jesus' birth. There is that biblically symbolic number again. After 8 days, Luke records in verse 21, "It was a time to circumcise the child, and he was called Jesus, the name given to the angel before he was conceived in the womb." Now, 32 days later, Jesus' parents again are performing their duty as pious and righteous Jews by returning to the temple. This time, in order to fulfill the legal and religious obligations by offering a sacrifice, consecrating their firstborn child and son to the Lord. They must have been in a solemn mood that day, full of reverence and expectancy, the way many new parents are who gather around our baptismal font to have their first child baptized. It is not hard for us to imagine, therefore, the solemn procession Mary and Joseph must have made to Herod's great and massive temple built upon Jerusalem's highest mount, their awe at entering its tall, ornate, holy courts, and their jitteriness as they purchase a pair of sacrificial birds according to the law. I bet you noticed they could have bought turtle doves. And this is not the second day of Christmas, but the 40th day after. About 10 years ago, I met at St. Andrew's by the Sea in Atlantic City a then young and newly minted New Testament scholar who began his tenure as a professor at Luther Seminary, following in his father's footsteps. In an article commenting on this Lucan passage, Stephen Holtgren offers this background information. The presentation of Jesus in the temple is motivated by specific requirements in the Mosaic law. According to Leviticus chapter 12, after a woman gives birth to a son, she is impure for 40 days. At the end of that period, which the priest offers as a sacrifice affecting his purification, she can return to the community. In addition, Exodus chapter 13 states that every firstborn male, whether human or animal, belongs to the Lord. Thus, the biblical notion that the firstborn son belongs to the Lord in a special way and is dedicated to serve the Lord. Luke's stress on the physical and biological, including concerns how an elderly couple, Zechariah and Elizabeth, might miraculously have a biological child, the conceptions of John and Jesus, childbirth and circumcision, and attention to purity laws as well as to rituals prescribed in the Torah serves to show, by Luke, both Jesus' humanity and his role in fulfilling God's promises to Israel. All this detail provides a counterargument to a movement that gained popularity in the second century, the movement known as Marcionism, named after Marcion, who concluded that the God of the Old Testament, or Hebrew Scriptures, was a distinct God from the one that Jesus proclaimed. Marcion's heresy is still alive and well in some churches today. It surfaces every time someone makes a remark about the Old Testament God of law versus the New Testament God of grace. It also appears when people talk about how the Ten Commandments do not apply to us. Luke's infancy account insists that the Old Testament is not to be dismissed, nor is it some dusty book to be kept on a shelf and trotted out to see how Jesus fulfills certain verses. When writing about the Marcion heresy, the wonderful scholarly St. Augustine said this: in the Old Testament, the new is concealed. In the New Testament, the old is revealed. It was through interpreting the scriptures that Jesus and his followers proclaimed their identity, for there was New Testament at that time. Luke claims for the followers of Jesus the traditions of ancient Israel and the Second Temple Judaism. As Father Abraham will tell the rich man in the famous parable of Luke chapter 16, they have the law and the prophets. They must listen to them. To understand Luke's gospel and to understand Jesus as well, we will do well to know the traditions that they knew, the stories that they were told, the laws that they held dear. The infancy narrative concludes when Mary and Joseph encounter Simeon and Anna, two elderly and righteous Jews. We first meet Simeon, who, like his counterpart Zechariah, the father of John the Baptist, whom we met earlier on this season in Jerusalem, serving in the temple, he, like Simeon, was righteous and devout. So it is not too far-fetched for us to imagine Mary and Joseph's reaction as an old man comes forward out of the shadows to scoop up their child in his arms and prophesy about him. Startled at first, perhaps even a bit frightened by the old man's enlightened and ecstatic face, The parents yield their child up to him because they sense the Lord's Spirit upon him. While Zechariah was in the temple, likely praying for a son, Simeon has a much broader intercessory petition in mind. He is looking forward to the consolation of Israel, which is translated in other versions as eagerly anticipating the restoration of Israel. Hearing Simeon's prophecy, the holy couple is reminded of the events of the previous weeks and months when angels and shepherds entered their lives to foretell the greatness of their son. How puzzled they must have been at the words that we call Simeon's song. Lord, now let your servant depart in peace. The words are familiar to many of you. In our Lutheran liturgical tradition, they appear in the Nunc Dimittis, from the Latin meaning, now send away, or let me now depart. This also forms the hymn sung after Holy Communion in some of our settings. Simeon's words also conclude the service of Compline, the order of prayers at the close of the day, and they can also be said and sung at funerals. Expressing thanksgiving to the Christ child and an earnest plea for peace, Simeon's song has become one of the most familiar and beautiful hymns in the liturgy. And yet, each time I, as a pastor, hear these words, as I imagine Mary and Joseph did, I grow strangely uncomfortable and even remorseful. For me, the memories and images of those whose bedsides I have been invited to offer prayers at the time of death, and the conduct of funerals to those who have become, like me, family, the words of Simeon in the Nunc Dimittis grow strangely uncomfortable. Listen to them again. Lord, now let your servant go in peace. Your word has been fulfilled. My own eyes have seen the salvation which you have prepared in the sight of every people, a light to reveal you to the nations and the glory of your people, Israel. Beautiful words, to be sure, but also troubling. For let's be honest about them. When Simeon asks that he be allowed to go, he is asking to die. Like a person waiting for an anniversary or a holiday or a grandchild to graduate, they're holding death off until that event occurs. There's no greater testimony of faith than a saint knowing that death is near, professing to the Lord their trust and preparation at the time of death. Come to think of it, it is appropriate for Luke to record this strange scene and song. Simeon's seemingly morbid request for death, just days after our celebration of Christmas, points us to the Christ who is no longer a child and the purpose for his death by crucifixion. The birth narrative of Luke's first two chapters prepare us for the next 22 chapters to come in Luke's gospel. As we painfully know and maybe have experienced, death does not take a holiday. That truth is never more apparent than during these holidays, when our hopes are joined with our fears, our expectations so often tinged with regrets, and our reunions sometimes overshadowed by unspoken disappointments or hurts. And to those who have lost a loved one in the past year, Christmas becomes a challenge, an obstacle. Most of us are reminded of those we have loved and lost by a stanza from a carol, a favorite ornament on a tree, or some fleeting but vivid memory of a past Christmas. Beloved people of God, Simeon is no different. He's an old man who has been around the block a few times. And so, like us who have lived long, we can imagine that he has tasted love and loss, joy and sorrow, hope and fear. And so he sings of death, not despairingly, but hopefully. For in this child cradled in his arms, Simeon does so confidently, because now he sees in and through this child, God will keep his promises to redeem Israel and save all the world. In this Christ child, in this babe in his arms, God has acted once and for all to address the question and specter of death with the promise of life. May each of us, at the time of our departure from this life, be prepared by our faith to let go and let God. And so we continue to treasure Simeon's song all these years after the event Luke records, simply because it tells us of God's great love for us, a love that even death cannot destroy. Amen.